Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo.
And tonight we are here to bring you some alternative news. And then we'll follow that with an interview with Larry Dorman, Public Affairs Coordinator for the AFSCME Union here in Connecticut. And actually, it's a recorded interview. The interview was done last night at Q103.3 FM in Lakeville, Connecticut, our FM show. And Larry will be commenting on the health care that's proposed and also commenting on the budget in Connecticut and the people that are running for governor against Governor Rell, who can't seem to come up with a budget.
And we talked about
but I guess we have one anyway.
We spoke about Ted Kennedy's
influence,
and what'll happen later. What Larry thinks might might happen. But we've got a couple of articles to read to you first.
In the meantime,
one is here. I thought it was pretty important. Lila will read it. Federal Reserve threatens economic disaster if forced to reveal secrets.
And this is from Global Research. The U.S. Federal Reserve asked a federal judge not to enforce her order that it reveal the names of the banks that have participated in its emergency lending programs and the sums they received, saying such disclosure would threaten the companies and the economy. The central bank filed its request on Monday, 2 days after Chief Judge Loretta Presker of the U.S. District Court in Manhattan ruled in favor of Bloomberg News, which had sought information under the Federal Freedom of Information Act. And I quote, "Immediate release of these documents will cause irreparable harm to these institutions and to the board's ability to effectively manage the current and any future financial crisis," the central bank argued. It added that the public interest favors a delay, citing a potential for significant harms that could befall not only private companies, but the economy as a whole if the information were disclosed. The clearinghouse, which represents banks in a separate filing, supported the Fed's call for a delay. It said speculation that the bank's liquidity is drying up could cause runs on deposits and trading partners to demand collateral. Survival can depend on the ephemeral nature of the public confidence. Clearinghouse General Counsel Norman Nelson wrote, "Experience in the banking industry has shown that when customers and market participants hear negative rumors about a bank, negative consequences inevitably flow." The Clearinghouse said its members include ABN AMRO Holding from Nevada, Bank of America Corporation, Bank of New York, Mellon Bank, Citigroup, Deutsche Bank, HSBC Holdings, J.P. Morgan, UBS AG, U.S. Bank Corp, and Wells Fargo and Company.
These are all Federal Reserve banks, by the way.
Yeah.
So if you might want to know them, because Federal Reserve banks, there's about eight banks that make up the Federal Reserve system, and they're all private corporations.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a federal anything, all right? It's a private-run corporation, and what we do is we authorize them as our agents and as our bankers, I believe, to issue the monies, all right? Issues the monies that we borrow.
Well, it seems to me like the Federal Reserve doesn't want to pump any more money into these banks right now.
No. But they're going to have to,
uh-huh.
I think, because those banks are falling. And they're still falling because of these problems that came.
So what did they do with all the money they were given?
They gave it, a lot of that money they gave, I read, they gave to foreign countries. They gave $1 trillion away to the god-awful Europeans to shore up their banks.
Okay, so that's called taxation without representation.
Right, and you have UBS.
Send it all to Europe.
They have UBC, and they have the World Bank of Scotland. We're all going under, belly under, and they're all members of the Federal Reserve as well, and lend money to their countries. So,
well, they should get their money from their taxpayers.
The problem is people started to wonder, where the hell are they getting all this money? Why are we?
From the little printing press in the back room. That's pretty good.
They're not even doing that. They're not even printing the stuff. They're just adding digits to a computer.
Screen,
you know, and just creating.
Well, someday they're going to have to crank out the money that they say they have.
Why?
These people want. Well, I suppose we're not going to have anymore.
More digits on that.
More digits on there.
More digits. That's all.
Well, they're going to have enough in. Excuse me. In circulation.
Well, that's why the United States supposedly put so much in deposit,
mm-hmm.
right? But taxpayers, you know, it was really crazy. We didn't have that. We borrowed it from them to throw back onto their accounts so that they could then lend upwards of 9 times what they have on deposit.
Yeah.
So that money all got lent out again to the United States to pay off its debt. It was crazy. It's crazy how it works. But that's how it works. And I was watching today, even Greenspan couldn't figure out the derivative market. He didn't understand what the hell was going on with that.
Really?
And he had people come in and talk about it, and they try to explain it. Nobody could explain it to him.
I don't think anybody knows what it is.
Nobody really understands how it really works, only that it does. And as long as most people paid their mortgage, it was a good, solid bet. But when they were figuring maybe 70 or 80% of the people would pay their mortgages regularly.
Uh-huh.
But what happened was only 20 or 30% could afford to pay their mortgages, and you know, so that those people gave out. So all of those mortgages went bad. So all of the derivatives are bad. And so, and then AIG insured all those derivatives and to the tune of $85 billion that $185 billion. That the United States bought out 80% of AIG so that it could insure the bank's insurance policies, you know, that it could cover it.
Oh,
it's really ridiculous. I mean, it's really sick. But anyway, what I wanted to add tonight was an article here. I thought this was kind of crazy, but this is what it's coming to. This is Mail Online, and this is from a British paper. Fudo, the health chiefs introduced their latest weapon on the war against swine flu, a dice game. It's true, it's called Fudo. It's a flu pandemic game, right? And it says, this came out yesterday, yeah. When swine flu first struck Britain, the government responded with helplines, distribution points for antiviral drugs, and promise of a vaccine by Christmas. By now, health chiefs have unveiled a bizarre new tactic to combat the virus, a role-play game using a set of dice. The flu pandemic game, which can be downloaded from the Department of Health's website, is for 3 to 60 players, takes about 90 minutes, and has chance cards, much like Monopoly. Initially devised by Camden Primary Care Trust in North London, the game is supposed to simulate the effects of a flu pandemic on staffing in an imaginary group of small businesses, and a version has also been developed to use in GP surgeries and hospitals. Players assume the identity of staff at imaginary workplaces. These include the Istanbul supermarket, where all 12 staff are male, in accordance with Muslim tradition. The game has 15 rounds, each responding one working week. At the start of each round, players roll a set of 4 dice, the number they roll indicating whether they will go down with swine flu. The first round, it takes a roll of 4 sixes to be condemned to the virus. But as the round goes on, the probability of each worker catching swine flu increases as the imaginary pandemic takes hold. By round 6, a player needs only roll 2 sixes to come down with the virus, which puts them out of the game for three rounds. And the surviving players are asked at the end of each round to discuss the impact that the pandemic has had on the various businesses involved. All right.
Oh, what fun!
Sick. I mean, what's wrong with this guy? All right. The instructions state, with a typical group of players, the game lasts between 45 minutes and 1 hour, but most players appreciate having an additional half hour for discussion afterwards. And once players have finished a game using imaginary persons, they play a second game using their real job titles. And perhaps unsurprisingly, the game also comes with a government health warning. Some people may find it disturbing to play using details of their own organization. The game is a simulation and has no effect on subsequent events, but it can seem a little like fortune telling. And the article is actually there's only a paragraph left. Unlike in real life, however, the game does not actually allow players to die because, as officials claim, it would make it too unwieldy. And the institutions explain, the flu pandemic game assures a zero mortality rate. The worst realistic case modeling scenario assumes a mortality rate of 0.37% based on the 1918-1919 pandemic. And the probability of mortality has not been included in the flu pandemic game because simulating such a small probability makes the game unwieldy and too long. And critics have complained that it is a waste of time and that the resources should have been directed to the government swine flu helpline, which is a good idea. And Catherine Murphy of the Patients Association said the game is a ridiculous use of time and money, and the government should be focusing on letting parents know how to get the drugs they need and whether they should be taking them. And the money and time spent on that game could surely have been better spent on organizing the swine flu helpline rather than actually helping parents. And 12 NFL spokesman refused to be drawn on how much the game has cost the taxpayer. And she said this is part of a suite of guidance by the department to support local health and social care services, robust pandemic action plans, and developing guidance as part of the department's normal emergency preparedness planning to ensure that the NHS is best able to respond. 66 people have so far died from swine flu in Britain, and 5,000 new patients were diagnosed last week. But earlier this week, it was revealed that two swine flu call centers were too close because they were receiving fewer calls than predicted. And what makes it funny is there was a follow-up article to that.
And I have it.
And you got it about the
swine flu call centers where staff have nothing to do but play cards and trivial pursuit. Two swine flu call centers are to close just weeks after opening because the staff have been spending most of their time playing cards and board games. Hundreds of thousands of pounds of taxpayer money has been squandered after around 1,200 workers were employed to deal with the expected deluge of anxious calls. But the staff said far fewer calls were made than predicted, and supervisors allowed them to play cards and games such as Trivial Pursuit and Monopoly to pass the long hour between calls. One said that for the most of the 4 weeks he was working at the National Health Center in Farnborough, Hampshire, each staff member took an average of just 2 5-minute calls per 8-hour shift.
Wow.
This is in England.
I know.
He said the whole thing has been a fiasco, and it seems to have been a complete knee-jerk reaction, set up with no real thought. I thought that was only our government that did that.
No, they're more bureaucratic than we are. Yeah.
I can't. You got to put your leg down because I can't see. I can understand the government had to prepare for the worst, but this was just ludicrous. They could have put these two centers into about one quarter of the size and still had scores of spare lines in case things really got bad. They've squandered a vast amount of public money needlessly. The National Pandemic Flu Service, which comprises phone lines and a website, was launched last month. The new staff were given 4 hours of training in how to read a prepared script of questions to discover whether a caller or a member of their family was showing signs of swine flu symptoms. But an email circulated last Sunday by Tim Abrahams, who ran the Farnborough call center, suggested that the staff actually spent most of their time playing games. The call center in Farnborough and another in Watford, which are both due to close tomorrow, are run by the National Health Service Professionals, a not-for-profit company which supplies temporary workers to the health service. There are another 17 smaller swine flu call centers run by other providers, although staff at some of those have also said that things are so quiet that supervisors have encouraged them to bring games. Earlier this month, the Daily Mail revealed that some phone lines were being manned by 16-year-olds with as little as 3 hours of training. The Department of Health said it was up to the individual centers on how they manage the staff. As the chief medical officer announced recently, we are scaling back the national pandemic flu service to reflect demand. This is a flexible service, so we can scale it back anytime when necessary. Schools are to reopen as usual next week, despite fears of the spread of swine flu. Children's Secretary Ed Balls announced yesterday. He said the latest advice to the government was that school closures were now of limited benefit in stemming cases of the virus. And that's the same thing that we said here, that
yes.
Closing the schools isn't going to do any good. Just
no.
If you're sick, stay home, or if your child's sick, keep them home and wash your hands.
Yeah, it's all this panic stuff.
You know,
doesn't make much sense.
Take precautions, you know.
Yeah.
Don't sneeze in somebody's face.
Right.
Dispose of your own tissues with your own hands. Don't leave them behind. And if you work with children, make sure that you frequently clean the tables that they sit at or
right.
desks that they sit at.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really the best that you can do.
Yeah. So that's our guidance for you this evening. And we shall, we're going to start an interview. It's about half an hour long or so with Larry Dorman. We may come back right after. We've got about, we still got about 10 minutes.
Well, here, let me read this one.
Okay.
This is from Alex Jones, Security Goon Crushes Free Speech. This Ain't America No More, by Paul Joseph Watson. In a damning incident of how the First Amendment has been eviscerated, footage from a recent town hall event showed a school security officer threatening a protester with arrest for holding up an anti-Obama sign while declaring that America has ceased to exist, arguing that unflattering representations of our dear leader are illegal. Despite the fact that there were numerous other signs being displayed at the healthcare event in Reston, Virginia, Security Officer Wesley Cheeks Jr. ordered the protester to pull down the placard, which featured the depiction of Obama as the Joker from Batman, with the words, "Organizing for National Socialist Healthcare, the Final Solution." An argument ensued before the protester declared, "This used to be America," to which the officer responded, "It ain't no more, okay?" Cheeks claimed that the protester couldn't display his sign because it included an image of Obama, like he's some kind of religious deity. Authority figures somehow think it's illegal to display a likeness of our ideal leader that is anything but flattering. As anyone with a basic grasp of history understands, when the authorities start opposing people merely for ridiculing those in power, dictatorship and tyranny soon follow. "Sir, leave the picture down," the officer said. "If you put that picture back up, you'll be charged with trespassing." The officer also ascribes upon himself the power to interpret and invent laws, growling, "If I told you once to take it down and you put it back up, I can charge you with whatever I want to charge you with." Cheeks, brazen contempt for the oath he swore to protect and defend the Constitution, is laid bare as he openly trashes everything America stands for and claims that in his eyes, the country, and by extension, the Bill of Rights itself no longer exists. This should act as a wake-up call to illustrate that shocking reversal of the role of police and security officers from peace officers to political enforcers for the corrupt state. Officer Cheeks is a member of the Fairfax County Public Schools trained school security officer team, who have refused to comment on the story until the office opens up again. I guess it was closed for the day.
Well, anyway.
Maybe closed as long as somebody keeps asking them questions.
Yeah. I got one more here for you, and before we go to the interview. And it's called, "In Another U-Turn, Obama Upholds Bush's Rendition Policy." That's by Press TV. This is Iranian, actually.
Yeah.
But the U.S. president backed Barack Obama makes another U-turn, recycling the Bush administration's controversial extraordinary rendition exercise. Upon taking office in January, Obama had ruled that the use of extraordinary rendition was illegal under his administration. However, administration officials said on Monday that the practice will continue under the Obama White House. The officials said that the administration will monitor the treatment of terror suspects sent to foreign countries for interrogation to ensure that they will not be tortured. Well, why are they sending them to other countries in order to for interrogation if they're not going to be tortured?
Well, that's why they're sending them to court.
Yeah. And the emphasis will be on ensuring that individuals will not face torture if they are sent overseas. The New York Times quoted one administration official as saying, human rights advocates, however, say that diplomatic assurances on the humane treatment of detainees will not constitute protection against abuse for prisoners sent to third countries with a history of torture. The Bush administration, which had sought and received similar assurances, was proven completely ineffective in preventing torture and was highly criticized over the practice, the rights advocates argued. Amrit Signe of the Civil Rights Liberties Union, the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union, yeah, who tracked rendition cases under George W. Bush, said that she was disappointed in Obama's decision to continue the rendition policy. It is extremely disappointing that the Obama administration is continuing the Bush administration practices of relying on diplomatic assurances, which have been proven completely ineffective in preventing torture. The Obama administration is setting up a new administration unit to be housed within the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, which will oversee the interrogations of top terror suspects using largely non-coercive techniques approved by the administration. The creation of the new unit, called the High Value Interrogation Group, will formally end the Central Intelligence Agency's primary role in questioning high-level detainees after years of abusive treatment complaints by lawmakers and human rights groups. And that's what they say. But it's just funny how Obama renewed the rendition.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Bush. I mean, the guy's Bush in blackface, I swear to God. You know,
it's really sad.
I had another liberal today who voted on my poll, talking, and she said she had just voted on my poll and said that Obama was doing a poor job. And right now, my poll on my website's at like 50-50.
Really?
Yeah.
That's higher numbers than what
you've
got on TV.
Yeah, it's pretty sad. So, anyway, thought that was interesting. So, if you can go to my site, which is lestoolshow.org, and vote there, too. And be surprised. I was very surprised at the, I started last month before, I think it was at 67% approval rating on the blog,
yep.
on the website, and now it's down to 50.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's considerable.
That's a fast
plunge. But it's funny, it's taking the same shape as the national polls. I think that's funny.
Yeah,
it's really interesting. So, you know, my several thousands of voters, you know, equate
segment
to,
is the same as the national. Well, you got credibility there, Leo.
It seems to be. So anyway.
So are we ready for our Larry Dorman interview?
Yeah, Larry Dorman's coming up with an interview, pre-recorded interview we did last night, and we'll be talking about Obamacare and labor issues and what Ted Kennedy's death means to the labor movement and the healthcare movement. And we'll be talking about that coming right up. So I hope you enjoy. It's about 35 minutes.
Security guards are not supposed to be carrying weapons outside the embassy except during official assignments. The four were taken to the police. Your opinion right now of the state of labor in the United States?
Absolutely relevant question. The state of American labor, I think, quite frankly, needs to be stronger.
Mm-hmm.
And that we need to have more of an impact in terms of the benefits and gains that we've secured on behalf of all working people. So I think that in this country, and particularly during this very difficult economic downturn, working people have fallen farther behind, healthcare is obviously a major concern. So there's a lot that we need our elected officials to do on behalf of working families, and certainly our labor movement, AFSCME, the AFL-CIO, we're committed to doing our best to raise the standard of living and to give working class people a stronger foothold in a very tenuous and often hostile economy.
Now, what's the state of the Employee Free Choice Act? Is that gone, or is it still simmering out there?
It's still simmering. That's a good way to describe it, but obviously I think it's taken somewhat of a backseat with
healthcare
debate that's going on. Clearly, it aroused the ire of the business community, which put a tremendous amount of pressure on members of Congress. So I don't know if I would characterize it as being on the back burner, but obviously it's certainly not at the forefront, and it's something, it's legislation that's really desperately needed, I think, to help level the playing field and to help advance the rights of working people. You know, every statistic shows that having union membership means you'll have better wages, better working conditions, health care, pension. It's the best anti-poverty program around. And I think we desperately need this legislation to help level the playing field, to put an end to the illegal activities that go on in the workplace in terms of repressing and intimidating workers' ability to join unions. So, you know, we need this legislation, but the fact is, particularly with health care and other things happening, it's not first and foremost, I think, on a lot of Congress.
I think that just to say, I think that there was a very big marketing problem there with that on behalf of the Democrats, and I just don't think that it was promoted properly. I think I've talked to you about this before, where I thought they got that whole thing got swift voted, you know, where, you know, just...
Huge thing was that scare tactics about secret ballots, and that was it.
Yeah, and people didn't even realize what it was. I mean, I have to admit, because I was very confused about that bill myself, and though I supported it, there were certain aspects of it that confused me, the way that it was being presented by the mainstream media, or even by the newspapers or
anyone who was covering it. Well, business managed to distort it.
Yeah, it became distorted, and the real, I thought the real aspects of the bill didn't come through.
I would agree with that, and it was presented as by its foes, and both in the business community and Congress, as something that would thwart workplace democracy, when in fact the Employee Free Choice Act is simply designed to restore a level playing field and strengthen democracy by making sure workers have the right.
But they're doing the same thing with health care.
Exactly.
Right,
I was going to actually draw that parallel, but I think
throwing up these death councils and throwing up any odd, awful thing that they can imagine,
right,
and then they have their spokesman come out and talk about it, and they get there first, and then all of a sudden Obama has to be, and everybody else supporting it has to be, on the defensive as opposed to taking the offensive here.
It almost seems as if, I think there is sort of a parallel in how the outcry against the Employee Free Choice Act has just been, multiplied potentially on health care. And right before the show, your show, or my appearance here on your show, I was reading Rolling Stone, one of the magazines we subscribe to, and Matt Taibbi, who does a wonderful job writing about corporate greed and about political backroom dealing for Rolling Stone, has a fascinating article in this current edition that I'd urge your listeners to read, and it's basically about congressional leadership and President Obama's mistakes and strategic missteps in promoting health care reform and almost dooming it to being something that's not going to address the problems of the uninsured and the underinsured. So, interesting parallel.
No, but here's a prime example of how the Democrats, or how Obama's White House, is losing the PR battle. Suddenly you got Dick Cheney coming up. Dick Cheney had the lowest ratings of anybody ever.
Politician ever.
Right? When he left office. Right?
Darkness.
And now he's coming back. challenging the Obama thing, all right, and making headway on it, because he suddenly said, he said something interesting the other day, and this was kind of interesting. He said, here's a guy who had absolutely no qualms about shooting three pirates in the head, all right, to save one hostage, all right. In other words, he said
Obama
shot three guys right in the head, okay. And, you know, to save the one passenger, the one hostage, right? But yet, here's a guy, he's saying, who refuses waterboarding and wants to investigate the guys who did the waterboarding, all right, or torturing to get this guy, to get this evidence. So right there, what he did is he threw this back at Obama and says, well, how trite is this if we, waterboarding doesn't kill anybody, all right? Gets the information out of this guy that we needed. He said, he says, what's wrong with this guy's thinking if he's allowed, if he can kill three pirates point blank, okay, who are holding a guy hostage, or
because he gave them the opportunity to let that guy go, and but they wouldn't.
What are you talking about?
The hostage, right?
No, I know, but what I'm trying to say is that it's no different than that. I mean, this is how the Obama White House is losing the battle. They're allowing these things to go unchallenged.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there was nobody who from the White House who came out and immediately challenged that statement. All right, they kind of brushed it up. Oh, it's Dick Cheney. What is But it's the thing is that here, every time Dick Cheney says something, every time some other
it gets repeated many times.
Right,
and goes into the psyche of the American people.
It's interesting. I absolutely get what you're saying. And,
yeah.
One thing that can't be underestimated is the ability of the Republicans and their apologists in the media.
Oh, man, they're unbelievable.
They are wonderful at destruction. You know, they're really skilled. You know, they have a plan that's built around destruction. It's built around blowing things up. It's built around throwing out as much panic as possible, scaring as many people. And, you know, sad to say that I think there's some effectiveness when you look at articles talking about the fact that Democrats could lose a significant number of seats in the midterm elections that'll be coming up next year. The opposition party has been very good in its destructive, in its pursuit of a strategy of destruction. The fact that, as you guys just pointed out, Dick Cheney, the Prince of Darkness himself, can somehow start rehabilitating himself and becoming a national figure tells you that something's going a little bit wrong.
I just wish
that Democratic leadership in Congress and elsewhere would be as feisty and as nasty as the Republicans are. Maybe
the thing is that there are some nasty pieces of work in the Congress, and nasty people, but they're directing it. They're not directing it at the right people. It's like Bernie Sanders. He's got a mouth on him, and he's quick to the temper, and he's always saying things off the cuff, and he attacks this woman in a town hall things. All right, I mean, she was just she didn't look like she was a problem or anything. She was just that, and he says, "Oh, you're as dumb as that." It's like talking to a dining room table. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's like that's the kind of problem, all right, that the Democrats are facing. They're not fighting the proper people. They're going after people they can, you know, beat up. But then there's another problem that they have with this. Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid and all of the leadership can't seem to agree to anything, on anything. And it's a public battle between they and the CIA and anything they can bring up, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It seems to come at them, and they're constantly being put on the defensive. And so their leadership hurts for that. And
I'm concerned that Ted Kennedy is gone, and what's going to happen to the health care there? I'm hoping someone can step up and be as strong as he was.
Well, I'm hoping stronger, because he was known to compromise, and it's like I'd like to see somebody who doesn't compromise on this, you know.
Well, and also, I think Lila's right, because he lent a strong and powerful voice to really important causes, whether it was health care or minimum wage or Employee Free Choice Act.
Yeah.
And yes, he could work the back rooms and the back channels and compromise with his opponents on the other side of the aisle. But I just think his voice will be tremendously missed, and I think his ability to get things done is going to be missed. It just creates a hole. And, you know, when you have so-called Democrats like Lieberman out there, a boon to the Republicans. It's a problem. I mean, he was a great man. We should pay tribute to him based on that. But the fact of the matter is, he'll be missed in the Senate for a whole lot of reasons.
Oh, I know. He has a mixed legacy, but
yes.
But he was truly human. But I do think he is a story in redemption. The last 20 years of his life, he did devote to really good causes, and hopefully this health care thing can be passed in his honor. I mean, he's worked.
He's not around, so there's no point in wishing he were.
Yeah.
But imagine if he were healthy, he were in the Senate, he would be such a powerful voice for reform and for change.
Yeah, he was on the wrong side of a lot of issues.
That voice is missing, and I don't really know who carries the mantle
in
place. But in some ways, it shouldn't come to this either. Democratic leadership again needs to, I think, rally around the president. I think they need to get out on the hustings in a more aggressive fashion. I think they need to take on the Cheneys and the Palins and the Limbaughs and all the far right ideologues who are out there suddenly kind of rehabilitating themselves and helping the Republicans pursue this path of destruction.
But these people are pugilistic. I mean, these people are like when you get on the guys on Fox, it's like being on the World Wrestling Federation. You know, it's like they're all out there. They're out for blood, and they don't mess around. Well, you get pansies like I call him a pansy because I think he is. You got guys like Oberman, play little nerdy games, little geek games, and call somebody a bad name and make a little fun of them, I like guys like O'Reilly's that call them straight out pinheads,
right.
Or whatever. I mean, these guys fight, and they fight. And you got Ann Coulter's out there who are, just screaming banshees. You know what I mean? That don't give up, and they have these extremely large followings. All right.
Not as large as you think.
And they got loyal supporters. All right. That back these people up.
I do want to be clear. I don't want to see the Democrats necessarily trying to create their own Limbaugh, their own Ann Coulter. I mean, these are repulsive people who have thrived and feasted on nurturing a culture of hatred and fear-mongering. So I don't want to see that kind of thing happening. But what I would like to see, obviously, would be members of Congress, talking heads in the media, adopt a much more aggressive stance be out there, with health care.
Right.
Embrace the public option. Don't run away from it. Point to Connecticut. Connecticut is a state where essentially there is a public option that competes along with private insurance companies. And I'm overstating it, but I mentioned to you before the state employee health plan is a marvelous example of cost containment, 0% cost increase in the last fiscal year. And it also holds the insurance companies accountable for their administrative practices. It essentially, creates an incentive to be efficient. So government can compete, and government can force the private insurance industry. But, get out there and just defend what's right, and that's what I think isn't happening.
Yeah.
So I agree.
And I'm disappointed at that, and I think we need some strong voices. I want to see a health care reform package passed. But I want to have that public option. I don't think that it'll be much good unless there is a public option in there.
Well, and look, I mean, from my own philosophical perspective, it's not that I want a public option. I just think that, it should be something modeled along the lines of what's going on in Britain or France or Canada.
Mm-hmm.
I think that stop trying to preserve a private system, that makes money by denying care. Let's admit, and that's what I'm talking about. We don't have to get personal. We don't have to create fear. We don't have to talk about death panels and euthanasia. Talk about...
wait just one second. I just have to... this over. All right.
Out of premium dollars and get very little in return and still face catastrophic illness and face catastrophic bills.
I mean, what...
talk about the soaring number of bankruptcies caused by accumulated health care debt. That's what they need to be doing, and unfortunately and sadly, that's not what seems to be happening.
Yeah, we hear silence. I mean, I don't know why people think that there is an already rationing of health care, even when you have insurance.
Exactly.
There are some things that you may want that you can't have.
Mm-hmm.
That your insurance company denies you.
It is sort of a self-negating system as it exists right now, because people either can't afford it altogether, or if they have it, the out-of-pocket costs are exorbitant, coverage is limited, and people opt not to get preventive care.
That's right.
They opt not to get the surgery they need or the help they need. So the system isn't working, and I think that somehow that's being lost. Millions and millions of people who are falling through the cracks because we have an inadequate private insurance system. That's the problem.
Well, let's hope when they come back in soon that they rev it up and up a notch and get out there and start really campaigning for this health care initiative, and I hope it happens.
I do, too.
And
to,
let's
and look, people are questioning why push it this year after everything that's happened with the bailouts and all the other issues. But, I do think it's good that this issue has been brought to the fore. But would I like to see some different approaches strategically? Absolutely, because it is a crisis, and it's only going to get worse. And it's going to lead us to a point, perhaps, come the revolution, because too many people are without insurance, and those that have it are paying exorbitant costs and getting so little in return and having their lives ruined that something has to give.
Well, who do you feel are responsible for the... do you feel that the people are actually legitimately angry out there? Are they being paid or put up...
If you go to the AFL-CIO and AFSCME websites and others, it's clear that this is part of the grand strategy in terms of stirring people up. The health insurance companies and their lobbyists are stirring up these so-called grassroots actions and speak-outs, and you have to acknowledge that there has been some impact. A lot of here in the Connecticut's 5th District, I've seen some pretty rotten behavior with a couple of the forums that Chris Murphy was trying to do. So it is absolutely part of the strategy to stir things up. I don't think it's reflective of the majority. If that's what you're asking,
I don't think it is either, Larry. Because even in the small circles that I kind of move in, like at the gym or at work or talking to people in the store, I have yet to find someone who says I don't want health care.
Exactly.
I just have not run into anybody that tells me they're not for health care. Everyone I've spoken to has said they are.
Now the question is, how do we fix the system?
That's right.
And I don't think people are, rational, sensible people know that, that this isn't about pulling the plug on granny, empowering people to take somebody else's life away. It's just, it's crazy stuff, but it's also not indicative.
Well, the only thing that was, as far as I could tell, was there was this clause in this provisional bill. Okay, it hadn't even been passed yet. But it was a clause in there that stated that they wanted people to have living wills, okay?
Right.
And the living will should be an issue brought up by a doctor, okay? And I, for some reason, I that doesn't bother me at all. I mean, everybody should have a living will. You know what I mean? If
Medicare.
If something happens to me, you pull the plug,
And look, Bush's Medicare overhaul, which ended up taking a lot of money out of the pockets of seniors who really can't afford it, had similar kind of incentivizing for end of life decisions. That's all it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's no different than what Bush was pushing. But again, the strategy of demonization, of making government the enemy, of planting the idea of conspiracies has overcome sensible, rational discussion.
I have to say there was only one person that I did talk to that said that they didn't want government in their health care. And my response to them was, so you think it's so much better to have big business in your health care.
Exactly. Because then you'll be paying through the nose and not getting anything in return.
Right. And you'll be getting those people who deal with the bean counters pulling the plug on Granny and you.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not going to pay for it.
Exactly. So, you know, the question is, do you want to have more of a non-profit mutual fund model?
Right.
That's going to give you a better chance. Or do you want to have the current system, which, as you said, is essentially a system of rationing anyway.
Oh, certainly.
We need change, and we need it now.
And making profit. And insurance companies are just middlemen for medical things.
And also Medicare.
Do we really need that?
Medicare was rated the most successful social medical program of all the industrialized countries.
We're talking about really is trying to replicate the Medicare model on a larger scale.
That's all we need to do. I mean, a single payer system Medicare model is fine. You know, I don't see why they just can't expand on that.
That's really, you know, Leo, you hit the nail on the head. That's really what ought to happen here is that if you think Medicare is a moderately or greatly successful program, that's really all that should be discussed, and that's really should be the framework.
Yeah.
Turning Medicare essentially into a healthcare program for all citizens. And if we could have the debate on that level, I think maybe we'd have some success.
I do too. I'd like to turn just for a second to the state of Connecticut and our budget.
Yep.
Do you think we're going to get one?
Yeah, I do. And obviously, people have been following what's going on. Morrell is faced with a decision about whether she's going to veto a budget that does raise taxes on millionaires. It pares down the estate tax, which is something that concerns me.
Yeah.
Lowers the sales tax in the situation. So I think what's going to happen, or what I'm hearing, is that she is likely not to sign the bill, so it will become law. So in other words, the budget compromise that everybody's reading about in the papers and hearing on TV and the radio will, in fact, go through because she's not going to sign it, and it's just kind of a continuation of her lack of leadership in presiding over this mess.
Don't we have two-thirds majority in the House and Senate?
Well, she's not going to sign it, but it's going to go through anyway.
Yeah, we've got the majority still in the House.
Right.
And Senate.
Well, yes, in numbers, yes, there's supposedly a veto-proof majority, but in some cases it didn't play out.
I don't know why. You'd think they would have rammed this thing down her throat.
The pooling, for instance, the pooling bill that we talked about on the last show, unfortunately, was vetoed by the governor, and it fell vote short in the Senate of an override. So,
it's
I think on the budget, though, I think you would see more than enough votes on both sides to do that. So,
I got to tell you something, and you'll laugh because Weicker said it so well about, I don't know how many years ago now, when he said that the thing that Connecticut does is it likes to elect Republican governors with Democratic, they like to have Republicans with Democrats.
Legislature,
so that the legislature can point, and the legislatures like to point to the governor, and the governor likes to point to the legislature, and absolutely nothing gets done, and it goes beyond it gets out of whack, you know.
Well, certainly the last 20 years plus, you've seen that from Roland on through Rell. With a brief period in the late 80s where the Republicans had the Senate, but Rell has just been a poor leader on every front.
Yeah.
And I'm certainly ready to see a Democratic governor come in and push through an agenda with the support of the legislature.
I think the facade is over. I think her facade is fading quickly.
I mean, who knows if she'll even run. But line is that it appears that this budget will become enacted into law just by the fact that she won't sign it. She's not going to veto it, but she's simply not going to sign it. So, it will become law with the passage of time.
Now, House Speaker James Amon, he's declared?
The former Speaker, yep.
Yeah. What do you know about him? What do you think about him? Do you think
he's one of the gubernatorial candidates. I don't think he has much of a chance. chance.
No.
Good guy, but he's certainly, kind of in the rear of the pack of contenders. It looks that Dan Malloy, the
Dan
Malloy. Stanford, is up front. Susan Bisewicz, the Secretary of State, and, you know, who knows, there's a state senator from East Hartford, Gary LeBeau, who's declared. So, you know, I think things are wide open, but I don't think Heyman is going to be there in the end. But I wouldn't underestimate him either.
So you think Dan Malloy is the front runner in...
Well, it's not that I think that. I think it's just at this early juncture, Malloy and Bisewicz are the two who have been out campaigning the most and who are raising money and making all the visits and stops to raise their profile. And Malloy's an impressive guy. He's done a lot of good things in Stanford, so it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Has he started to court the union yet?
I'm sorry?
Has he courted you guys yet?
Absolutely. He's the Connecticut Working Families Party actually held a forum at our Union Hall in New Britain last Saturday, and Malloy, Heyman, Bisewicz, LeBeau, all the candidates showed up, so they're clearly
out and ready, huh?
Supporting labor.
Well, good.
That's good. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
It most certainly will. We're in for a wild coaster ride.
Yeah.
Well, that's
roller coaster. It's going to be interesting. And I just hope that your listeners and you guys will have a chance to enjoy yourself on Labor Day. It's when we honor the contributions of the American worker, and it's a day that we all have to kind of renew to keep fighting for what we stand for all year round. You know, fair wages, decent health care, a secure retirement, a voice at work. Those are all good things that benefit all Americans.
Do you still have that retrospective on your website?
I'm going to be posting. Boy, you're good, and I'm going to be posting that up in the next couple of days.
Yeah,
so we'll definitely get the little Labor Day background in history.
Yeah.
And before, I know time's running out, but I bet some of your listeners may not know that the first Continental Congress was held in a hall built by Union carpenters back in 1774.
There you go.
Oh, that's an interesting fact. I didn't know that myself.
Yeah. So it's a special holiday for us, and hopefully a day when we can recommit to the values that we stand for all working Americans.
So the Council4.org, when will that be up on your site?
Yep. You put the onus on me, and I should have it up by end of day tomorrow.
There you go.
So
everybody can check that out.
Good.
And check out the history of Labor Day with Council4.org.
Terrific.
And
I really appreciate you guys having me on.
Well, thank you very much. And remind us all of our commitment to the American worker. And I'm glad that Labor Day is coming up, so we'll be officially celebrated.
So thanks so much, Larry.
All right, you take care.
Okay, thank you.
Good night.
So Larry Dorman, Public Affairs Coordinator for AFSCME Union, talking to us about health care and also talking a little bit about who's maybe running against REL and the state of the budget there.
But we thank them so much, and Larry is a great guest.
Oh, very good.
So we will be leaving you now.
All right, I hope you enjoyed that. That was that was our interview with Larry last night. We got about 5 minutes left for the show, and I thought I might feature some news. Some more news with views. And next week, tomorrow night, we'll be doing our usual spiritual program, but dealing with esoteric wisdom. And then Friday night, we have a special show with you. We're going to be joined by George Dixon, but also his friend Peter Moon, who wrote and published actually the Montauk series, and he's got a special book out, a new book out called The Transylvanian Sunrise, and that's dealing with Montauk issues that developed in Romania actually, they had a time travel study program going on there that paralleled the Eastern European remote viewing and mind control operations there and time travel operations there, mirroring the ones in being done in Montauk in Long Island. So, and in the United States. So we're going to be talking to him and George on Friday night, so I hope you look forward to that. And will join us right here at 8 o'clock, 8 to 9. And as for tonight's show, I want to thank you all for joining us. And I wanted to bring up something else before we close, dealing with the swine flu. But there was something else I thought that was even more. I'm just trying to find the article here. I'm sorry. It had to do with. I thought this would be a good one to close out with tonight, since this is something that nobody really talks about anymore, and it should be talked about. And unfortunately, I had to find this in a Russian paper, Russian Today, RussiaToday.com. And it states that hundreds of 911 first responders die of cancer. New York's emergency services were among the first in the scene of the 911 disaster, but put their personal safety in jeopardy. And those involved in the rescue and cleanup operation quickly became national heroes. But now 85% of them are suffering from lung diseases, which they say were caused by the huge clouds of dust, and those people are now calling on the state for medical support. So far, the U.S. government has refused to help them. John McNamara is the most recent Ground Zero first responder to die from cancer. He battled to save lives that day, but lost his own battle just at age 44. A victim of his own bravery. And his courage was commemorated at St. Patrick's Cathedral, where McNamara's funeral took place. Today, his son Jack McNamara is still too young to understand his father's actions that day. All he knows is that Dad was a firefighter. And he said, "I and other families of the victims are so devastated that so many of these flagrant or valiant firefighters who struggled to find my son and to save others are now paying the price," says Sally Reigenhart, whose son died in the 911 attacks. City, state, and federal officials have not acknowledged the direct link between the cancer cases and Ground Zero toxins, and Congress has yet to approve 911 health legislation calling for federal financial coverage of health costs for rescue workers. John McNamara spent about 500 hours at Ground Zero aiding in rescue and recovery. And nearly 8 years later, the scene here is all about rebuilding. But as the hole in the ground grows smaller, the list of 911-related deaths is growing longer and longer. And the government pays for these, and I pay for these. Retired officer, police officer Mike Valentin, has had four biopsies for a precancerous tumor in his throat and has to take 15 pills a day. He calls 911 America's Chernobyl. And he says the people that will die from the illness will surpass the number of people that were killed on 911. I am talking about thousands, tens of thousands of people that will come down with cancers, forecasts 911 first responder Valentin. Valentin said he spent 4 months digging through debris at Ground Zero after U.S. officials announced the air was safe. And Valentin, the father of three, says this, he spends $15,000 a year on medication the government won't cover, and that's the U.S. leaders have, and the U.S. leaders have turned their backs on the heroes they promised never to forget. Our families are not looking to put Mercedes Benz on the front yard. We're not looking to take European trips, says Valentin. We're looking to take care of our families when we die, and the time he has left, Mike Valentin vows to continue fighting for the compensation he believes 911 first responders deserve. Valentin founded a 911 Police Foundation to help retired first responders in need of medical assistance, and among them Patrick Triola, who spent months searching the Ground Zero and then became victim of kidney cancer. During those days, Stephen Grossman, son Robert, was also aiding in rescue and recovery. He was diagnosed with a terminal brain cancer in 2006 at 39 years old. Today, he remains in a coma. Now, you can catch this at RussiaToday.com, but it just seems funny that you only hear about this stuff in foreign papers, and you don't hear any more about it in the American news media. So from there, I want to thank everybody for joining me. I hope you got something out of tonight's program. We try to give you as much information as we can in the short period of time. I want to thank you again, and please join us tomorrow night and Friday night. And have a pleasant evening.